Hello and welcome to another episode of our irregular podcast run by the editorial board of Prometheus, a journal for socialism and democracy. My name's Edmund Potts, and in this episode I'm going to be reading one of my articles from summer of 2020, and it's entitled Why Do We Have a Labour Party Instead of a Socialist Party? What sort of an organisation is the Labour Party? Its dominance of the left in Britain for over a century has produced no shortage of activists who are members, without being very enthusiastic about their membership. Various descriptions have been formulated, but while all have an element of truth, none quite tell the whole story. Is Labour, as the membership cards would have it, a democratic socialist party? Or perhaps Tony Benn had it right when he said that Labour is not a socialist party, but a party with socialists in it. Is it a unique phenomenon defined by its own special philosophy of labourism? Arguably all of these descriptions are correct, but none of them are particularly helpful in drawing conclusions about what, if anything, socialists should do in the party. Nor do any of these formulae contain an explanation of how that state of affairs arose in the first place. It would hardly be advisable to try and answer all of these questions in one article, but what follows is a historical argument which may inform those answers. Although it maintains fraternal ties with them, the Labour Party has a different structure and heritage from the modern social democratic parties of continental Europe. Like Labour, these parties have all been through more than a century of assimilation into the capitalist order, from support for their own ruling classes in the First World War, through to their embrace of the neoliberal consensus and attacks on working class living standards in recent decades. Like Labour, they now adhere more or less to a centrist, social democratic politics of slightly expanded welfare spending within the general neoliberal framework of privatisation and subordination to the needs of business. But at the time of their birth, they adhered to the principles of Marxism. Social democracy was simply the term in use at that time to describe organised socialist politics, and didn't have its modern connotation of centre-left parties aiming merely at a fairer capitalism. Socialism is a democratic project by which the working class, the great majority of people who are separated from the means of production and thus forced to sell their labour to survive, will win the battle of democracy and displace the capitalist class as the dominant force in society. They can then use this power to establish common democratic ownership of all society's resources, building a society in which those resources are allocated to satisfy human need rather than profits for a tiny minority. This is a very simple idea, and yet the idea in itself is not sufficient. It cannot simply be proclaimed like a new Sermon on the Mount. It must be argued and campaigned for if the working class are going to take it to heart and use it to emancipate themselves. To wage such a campaign, to win support for socialist ideas among the working class, and for it to then use those ideas to become the dominant class, requires the existence of a mass democratic socialist party. To see how this can be done, we can look at some of the earliest Marxists, those who called themselves social democrats in the late 19th century. Socialism was not a new idea at this point, but thanks to the contribution of Marx and Engels, it was now well understood that it would have to be established by a self-conscious working class acting in its own interests, and not by a conspiratorial coup d'etat or as a result of the ruling class's benevolence. Karl Kautsky, the leading theoretician of Marxism after the deaths of Marx and Engels, described the essential formula of social democracy as being the merger of socialism and the worker movement. This merger formula was applied with great success by the German Social Democratic Party, the SPD, and its predecessor organisations from 1869 to 1914, during which time it became the most popular party in the German Empire, even under conditions of state repression. Millions of German workers were drawn into a mass party that functioned as a state within a state and campaigned for a socialist society as well as the immediate reforms needed to improve the condition of the working class. In Britain, however, this social democratic perspective never became the dominant trend on the left. Minor left-wing organisations such as the Communist Party of Great Britain, founded in 1920, and the various Trotskyist groups, can trace their descent from revolutionary social democracy, but At best, they resemble only a cheap imitation of the original. These organisations never came close to hegemony over the left or over the working class, and the force which did, the Labour Party, was based around a different perspective entirely. This is one reason why the British working class has, for over a century, been saddled with a compromising Labour Party that serves it so poorly, rather than the mass socialist party it so desperately needs. Perhaps a good measure of the weakness of the early socialist movement in Britain is the fact that its foremost organisation, the Social Democratic Federation, or SDF, is today forgotten by all but a handful of scholars and enthusiasts of socialist history. Part of this forgetting is deliberate and convenient. The SDF was an integral partner in the foundation of the Labour Representation Committee in 1900 that would go on to become the Labour Party, and that is an uncomfortable fact for today's right-wingers who declare that Marxists apparently have no place in the Labour Party. To today's Marxists, the SDF is principally remembered as a useless sect, the object of Friedrich Engels' unending scorn. Socialists would benefit in general from a more nuanced and detailed understanding of our movement's history, even including flawed organisations such as the SDF. However, if we take as our starting point the clear and obvious failure of the SDF to emulate the German SPD and become hegemonic among the working class by merging its ideas with the workers' movement, we must then seek to understand why this failure occurred, as this was a failure not only of a particular organisation, but also of the prospects for revolution in Britain. In contrast to the SPD, which overcame its birthing pains to unite around a Marxist programme at its Congress in Erfurt in 1891, the SDF never reached this level of political coherence. The party was deeply divided even on such basic questions as whether socialists should support trade unions, or whether they were in fact useless to the cause of socialism. Furthermore, the organisation was from its inception under the authoritarian grip of its founder, Henry Hindman, who was described by Engels as an arch-conservative and an extremely chauvinistic, but not stupid, careerist. A businessman who provided much of the organisation's initial funding, Hindman's careerist aspirations and bureaucratic manoeuvres, which included taking money from the Tory party to finance two election campaigns, severely retarded the SDF's development. He was also vociferously hostile to trade unions, which meant that the best of the Marxists in the SDF were hamstrung in any attempts to adopt and apply the social democratic merger formula. Marx and Engels' justifiable hostility to Hindman translated into scorn for the SDF, and it meant that even though the two founders of scientific socialism were based in England rather than their native Germany, the SDF and its genuine socialists, who were clearly groping towards the merger formula, were woefully under-resourced in terms of political and ideological support. It took decades before the key texts of Marxism were even translated into English, and thus the opportunist leaders of the SDF were able to write their own derivative but corrupted theory to fill the vacuum. While the forces of socialism which should have made up one half of the merger equation were so weak and deformed, Britain's workers' movement was going from strength to strength during this period. Trade unions had been acknowledged as legal entities from 1871 onwards by the state. This was followed in the 1880s by an upsurge in so-called new unionism, what today would be called organising the unorganised, which blew away some of the cobwebs of so-called craft trade unionism as a force by which skilled workers had defended their privileges. In contrast, at this time in Germany, both socialists and the trade unions were going through an intense period of state repression, semi-outlawed by the anti-socialist laws of Bismarck, Chancellor of the German Empire. This repression and the recognition that political liberty was absolutely essential to the existence of both the socialist and the trade union movements helped drive the two halves of the merger required for social democracy closer together and acted as a catalyst for their merger. The effective absence of a mass social democratic party in Britain did not destroy the inherent desire of the workers' movement for political representation, but instead meant that the increasingly powerful trade unions looked elsewhere for partners and schemes to fulfil this desire. right-wing elements in the movement, such as the Fabian Society, which sought to neuter the transformational potential of the socialist movement in favour of gradual reform, found a receptive audience among these union leaders, who also favoured class collaboration and caution in order to safeguard their positions and the apparatus that put them there. The same partnerships emerged in Germany between trade union leaders and so-called revisionists in the SPD, who rejected the ultimate goal of a classless society and emphasised the immediate goals of the movement. In Britain, the trade unions had increasingly outgrown the meagre representation conceded to them by supporting Liberal Labour candidates, but Britain's Marxists were either incapable or unwilling to take advantage of the opportunity which therefore presented itself to them. Into this void stepped the forces of what would become the Independent Labour Party. Formed at a conference in 1893, the ILP committed itself to socialism, but in vague terms that left its politics broad and nebulous. Indeed, for many years, its first leader, Keir Hardie, advertised the party to prospective members in the following terms. It is sometimes charged against the ILP that it has never formulated its theory of socialism. That is true, and therein lies its strength. Delegates at the ILP's founding conference adopted the party name in preference to Socialist Labour Party, with one activist remarking that he would sooner have the solid, progressive, matter-of-fact, fighting trade unionism of England than all the harebrained chatterers and magpies of continental revolutionists. The political influences at play within the ILP were diverse, but the trend which was to win out was that which favoured political compromise in the interests of increasing working-class representation, rather than a principled socialist politics. To return briefly to the experience of the German socialists, within 2 years of the first Social Democratic Party's founding in 1869, they had succeeded in electing two of its members to the Imperial Assembly, or Reichstag, one of them being August Bebel, the celebrated working-class woodworker who educated himself in Marxism. This served as a springboard from which social democracy acquired an ever greater voice in the politics of the country, increasing its number of seats at successive general elections, despite unfair electoral laws and, crucially, symbiotically supporting the trade union movement against state crackdowns. The ILP's early track record was, by comparison, a disappointing failure. With Hardie having won a seat in Parliament as an independent prior to the founding of the ILP, the party's prospects going into its first general election in 1895 might have appeared hopeful. In the event, none of its 28 candidates succeeded, and Hardie lost his own seat. Utterly demoralised by the experience, the ILP followed the lead of those figures who argued that to have any prospect of winning elections and increasing independent working-class representation, it should look to gain the support of the trade unions rather than waste any more time on pursuing unity with other socialists such as the SDF. This formula was described as the Labour Alliance. As well as Hardie, leading figures pushing this perspective included Ramsay MacDonald and Philip Snowden, who decades later would end up forming a cross-class national government with the Conservative Party and splitting the Labour Party. As we have seen, social democracy consists of the merger of socialism and the workers' movement. On the face of it, therefore, a turn by socialists towards the organised forces of that movement, the trade unions, could have been a key step towards the establishment of a true social democratic or mass socialist party. However, in this case, the model of cooperation pursued was not a merger, but something quite different. The proposal for a Labour alliance gathered steam and led to the establishment in 1900 of the Labour Representation Committee, which in turn became the Labour Party in 1906. The Labour Representation Committee included the ILP, the SDF, various trade unions and the Fabian Society. Although present at its birth, the SDF quit in confusion within 18 months and were denied reaffiliation once the more principled elements in the SDF had finally won control of the organisation and sought to rectify this mistake. The non-socialist character of the LRC was evident and acknowledged at the time by Hardy. What followed, as has been made plain by a century of history, were countless capitulations and accommodations by the Labour Party to capitalism. The Labour Party, in national and local government, has tended to act as a brake on the working class movement, and on many occasions actively attacked the living standards of the working class, unless pressured to do otherwise by a mass movement from below. Hardy defended the Labour Alliance to the end of his life, and sought to assert that his approach was the authentic application of socialist orthodoxy, as well as being the more pragmatic. In his 1910 pamphlet, My Confession of Faith in the Labour Alliance, he disparaged those who regarded the ILP and the Labour Representation Committee as insufficiently socialist, with well-aimed barbs directed at the SDF, which chime with the analysis in this article. But the seeds of his downfall are illustrated in one of his boasts, where he says, "The conversion to socialism and the political organisation of the working class is no light task. The forces arrayed against us are powerful and unscrupulous. We have thus far achieved a very gratifying success, but much still remains to be done. The secret of our success has been our ability to unite men of diverse gifts, giving each an outlet for his special talent. By opening the way for the chiefs of the late great labour organisations to join with us without loss of self-respect or sacrifice of principle on their side, by magnifying points of agreement and minimising points of difference, and by the exercise of a wise toleration. Any strategy which involves an unprincipled alliance with labour chiefs, of a type which is of course familiar to us today, to obtain their practical support without challenging their politics, is doomed to failure. It is completely different to the original social democratic perspective of seeking to merge principled socialist politics with the forces of the workers' movement. Moreover, the pragmatic approach of avoiding thorny questions of political principle appears to have blinded the relatively leftist Hardy to the real character of the other ILP leaders like MacDonald, who would act so unscrupulously once they led the Labour Alliance into government and then on to near destruction. The political consequences of the Labour Alliance approach endure to this day. Hardy frequently noted with satisfaction how the programme of the Labour Party had always refrained from making so-called political demands on matters such as constitutional reform. This was of course part and parcel of the party's enduring loyalty to the British state, as described by Ralph Miliband in his book Parliamentary Socialism. But the roots of this misguided loyalty lie not so much in the backwards political opinions held by this or that Labour leader, but in the form of the Labour Alliance itself. By squandering the historic potential of merging its socialist politics with the workers' movement, and instead deferring to the politics of the short-termist and defensive trade union bureaucracy, the ILP foreclosed on the possibility that the Labour Party might be established as a vehicle for the socialist transformation of society. So much then for the past. Could things have turned out differently? It seems likely that a serious factional struggle to transform the ILP into a politically coherent socialist organisation could have stood some chance of success. Despite thousands of activists being members of both the SDF and the ILP simultaneously around the turn of the century in a general atmosphere of non-sectarian cooperation, the SDF was unable to give a lead to such a struggle, focusing instead on fruitless initiatives to unify the two organisations from above rather than focusing on establishing firm political leadership on solid principles. Conducting a thought experiment in which the SDF had been established not as a Marxist party, but as a non-socialist or apolitical Labour Party, Kolkowski asserted that, "Once an independent workers' party has been formed, it will with natural necessity sooner or later adopt a socialist outlook, if it has not been filled with such an outlook from the very beginning, and finally, it must become a socialist worker party, that is, social democracy." Needless to say, this perspective in regard to Britain was either wrong or is yet to be proved right by events. Over a century since its founding, the Labour Party has not become a socialist party, and in some ways is further from this goal than ever before. The disastrous defeats and capitulations of the Social Democratic parties in Europe and elsewhere in the 20th century show that the victory of a Social Democratic perspective over the so-called Labour Alliance perspective in Britain would certainly not have solved all of the left's problems. However, the existence of such a mass socialist party, based in the working class, committed to a socialist transformation of society, and with a clear programmatic perspective of how to bring this about, would be a significant step forwards for the working class of any country, including Britain. The road to the establishment of a mass socialist party has been through many twists, turns, and unexpected diversions. Doubtless it has more to come in the future. But the first and most obvious step in order to make this a reality is for socialists to unite and organise around this strategic vision.